Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. Morning all. Today I'm going to talk about humanism and Zen. So Buddhism, as you know, started in India, and those of us who took this class this fall on the roots of Buddhism know that it grew and it changed in relation to Indian thought. The Indian thought that came before Buddhism. Ideas like the concept of reincarnation, for instance, or the six realms. These are things that affected Buddhism. And at the same time, Buddhism repurposed some of those things and affected the general thoughts about those things in the society in which it grew up in India. When Buddhism moved to China and Zen was born, Zen was affected by the dominant philosophies of the day, in particular Taoism and Confucianism. Some say that, you know, Zen is a kind of came to be because Buddhism met Taoism. And I think Confucianism had a great effect on it as well. And in the rise of Zen monasteries and the way the practice was structured and the emphasis on lineage, all that came from Confucian ideals. And the poetic tradition of Zen really clearly came from the Taoist tradition. So, in our case, now Zen moves to America and the West, and what is our dominant paradigm here? The case could be made for Christianity, I think, but I'm going to make the case that, well, I'm actually not going to really make the case, I'm just going to say that I think that it's humanism, liberal, secular humanism, and the ideals of the Enlightenment that are really the bedrock of our society here. Christianity's mixed in there, of course. But today I want to talk about this Enlightenment tradition that I grew up with. I'm a child of the Enlightenment. And that I love, too. I feel I am a secular humanist, as well as a Zen Buddhist. How do those two traditions talk to each other? How do they relate? That's, I'm a Zen teacher, and that's my primary focus. But I also think it's important for us, certainly for me, to consider what kind of culture we're this tradition is moving into, and what the kind of sympathies are, and where also we have differences. I think it's important that we admit those differences and see them. I think it's possible for instance, Zen to be kind of, to either not learn from the culture that it moves into, or not learn enough, or be overwhelmed by that culture. I am not a scholar, of course, so the things that I say, you should have more faith in the Zen part of the things that I say rather than the Enlightenment part. And when I say humanism, I really mean more broadly the whole Enlightenment tradition that really starts in the late 17th century. You know, sometimes it's dated starting with, what's his name? Isaac Newton and the Scientific Revolution. And but Immanuel Kant later, when he sums up what is enlightenment, he says, "Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity. Immaturity is the inability to use one's understanding without guidance from another." This was a breaking out from the traditional mold of the traditions that ruled, that governed society. I've been influenced by, you know, recently, I've been interested in the 17th, in the 18th century for a long time. My father was a colonial historian, and I studied American history in college. That was my major. But, you know, reading Steven Pinker's History of Violence and then now his new book, Enlightenment Now, that's reawakened my interest in that period and also this tradition. So Pinker has lists four Enlightenment values: reason, science, humanism, and progress. It goes through those. He wants us to appreciate them, by the way. And when under the heading of humanism, that subheading, he says humanism is the, roughly speaking, the privileging of the well-being of men, women, and children over the glory of tribe, race, nation, or religion. Okay, so it's going to be a little listy, but we don't mind lists in Buddhism. Here are some points of intersection that I see between these two traditions. One is the importance of human well-being. It's something I really appreciate about the Buddhist tradition, that you know, over your relationship with God or your relationship with the tribe, even your own religious tribe. The Buddha, when he died, his last words were said to be a light unto yourself. Don't just parrot me. You'll be okay. And Zen attempted, I think, one of the things that it attempted to do was rekindle that spirit, by talking about Zen as a finger pointing at the moon. When you find the moon, you don't need the finger anymore. The well-being, the spiritual well-being of individuals is really, I think, what the Buddha and Buddhism is first and foremost about. Interesting, there's a couple of articles by Sogyen Hori, this professor at McGill University who's now moved to the West Coast, who talks about how even in Japanese Zen monasteries, which you think is very organized, it's his contention that the practice there is actually pretty rough around the edges, because it's more interested in teaching the monks how to take initiative, how to be creative, than it is in keeping everything running smoothly. That might sound kind of wrong to you, but that's a discussion for another day. But that's I find that very interesting, and it has informed my way of looking at the practice. So human well-being at the top. Buddhism doesn't have a god that has a plan for you or me, just like humanism doesn't. There's no higher power that has a control over our destiny. And we will gain no privilege by knowing that power. I think also there is a... Okay, so now you take out God from the equation, and the empiricists of the 18th century were then interested in what then is the self, if it's not a kind of a broken image of God. And they, a number of them, came to the conclusion that there is no self. David Hume, for instance, has some thought about maybe he was influenced by Buddhism. But the when you really take it down, there is this kind of similarity between the view of the self in this new enlightenment way of seeing things and the Buddhist way of seeing things. I think also that that science, reason, critical thinking are at the very least not opposed to Buddhism. You know, the Buddhist was a kind of scientist. He was very interested in what works, not in hewing to one particular way of looking at things. And I think there is a tradition of self-criticism and flexibility in the Zen tradition that is, you know, that I don't know if I'd call it scientific, but it has harmonies, in my view, with the scientific tradition. For instance, you know, you read these koan cases, and there's the case, and then there's the commentary, and the commentary sometimes criticizes the thinking of the, you know, of the case. Not to mention the fact that there is no single book that we revere. It's a work in progress. Yeah. And finally, that, you know, in terms of the self-criticism, I mean, the, you know, there's a, in Zen there is this kill the Buddha motif, or what is Buddha? Buddha is a shitstick, you know, and that kind of don't get too attached to the wisdom of the old folks. Okay. So I think those things are kind of sympathies. Some points of difference. Zen sure looks like a religion. It kind of smells that way when you walk in. You smell the incense. And it has these rituals and bodily practices, which for a humanist seem like they're a little much. Kind of reminds me of an old joke. What do you get when you... I don't know if this fits really, but... What do you get when you cross a Jehovah's Witness with an atheist? Someone knocking on your door for no reason. There is this kind of like... this instinct to do these rituals, but they're not handed down by God. In fact, actually, I think that... and we have to now decide what to keep and what to ditch, of course. But God didn't tell us to do these things. They're here for a reason. They're here to move energies. They're here to teach us something about how to live. So, and Zen is a practice. It's a physical practice. Something that I think humanism doesn't have so much of. It's a set of ideas or ideals. Also, Zen values sitting still, and enlightenment values, the values of the enlightenment, or humanism values, progress. Mm. And Zen values progress too, but it also very much values no progress. It values that state of no progress, of stillness, of stopping. Zen also... Do I want to get into that? Well, Zen has a certain romantic side, which I think has a resonance with romantic, poetic, imaginative side, which I think has a resonance with what sometimes is called the counter-enlightenment or the romantic movement that came after the Enlightenment. And I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole right now, but that I do see that as a difference. And finally, I think that Zen tends to be about, tends to concentrate on what's going to be good for individual practitioners and help them. Of course, Asanga is a big part of that, but and what's going to help them live their lives fully and contribute to society. Humanism and the Enlightenment was largely focused on how to organize things, how to organize institutions, Steven Pinker says. Rather than trying to shape human nature, the Enlightenment hope for progress was concentrated on human institutions. Okay. I got two more sections left. One is what I think humanism might contribute to Zen, what we might learn from humanism. And then I have the reverse, what humanism might learn from Zen. So humanism contributing to Zen. I think it's the institutional life that humanism can most help Zen. In the way that we structure our institutions. As a good child of the Enlightenment would, I believe that the way we structure institutions does have a big effect on the individuals within it. And funnily enough, I think in Western Zen, I'm not sure we appreciate that as much as maybe we should. I mean, Eastern Zen in Japan and China was a monastic tradition, and it was very much within a system, an institution. And in the West, I think, to some degree or another, maybe because it came up in the 60s, we often want to talk about personal awakening and sort of devalue the role that institutions and institutional life and community play. Because I learned my Zen in an institution, I feel that the way we structure an institution does have a big effect on the way we practice. And I feel that both the negative and the positive effects. I'm one who believes that bringing democratic principles, humanistic principles into the practice is not a threat, it's a benefit. I think that we can restructure some of our institutional structures and still honor experience, people who are more experienced along the way. Zen, I know, comes with a certain amount of Confucianism all tangled up with it. Just like any other tradition does, you know, who's come over, the Tibetan tradition, for instance, has its own things wrapped up with it. And this, one of the places where this shows up most, I think, is in authority. It's complicated. Sogen Hori makes some good points that might contradict what I have to say. But in general, I think the Japanese system, especially the Rinzai system, can be skewed toward those at the top, the very kind of 1%, because it has this, you really want to get this enlightenment to the next generation. You need one person to do that. And there is, a Western monk I've been talking to recently in Japan, who's been there for a long, long time, reminded me of this concept of one or a half. It just takes one of what a teacher really needs is one good student or a half. There's like a phrase, one or a half, in Japanese. And I think there's something to that. We do need a few people who are willing to really soak themselves in this practice and for a long time, and people who can feel this Buddha nature deeply and understand it down to their bones. At the same time, I believe we can have both. I really do. And I can't help but think that some of the one or a half is, especially when it's too skewed that way, is a vestige of Confucianism. You know, when you look at Japanese Rinzai Zen in Japan and Zen in general, you know, it's possible that one of the things that it was, because it wasn't interested so much in connecting with common folks, it feels a little bit like a museum piece now. That may be one reason. And I think also there is a possibility that in Zen we have the wrong idea of what it is to be an enlightened being. Even that phrase is gives me shivers. I think we have to learn, we have to know that clearly that people who have been doing Zen for a long time, people who are masters, can be very wise in certain ways and foolish in others. My teacher, who I think had great insight, also had great big problems. And he misused and abused his position of power, exploited women, and made for all manners of problems in our Sangha. And those problems, I think, were exacerbated. I saw this, you know, by the idea that he was a living master and somewhat beyond reproach. So I think there is a kind of romantic strain in Zen that is worth looking at. The mystique around the enlightened master, the kind of hagiography that grows up around that. Yeah, and then also I think there is another romantic strain sometimes pops up in Zen, which is kind of declinism. There is a theory actually in Buddhism that goes back, it doesn't go back to the Buddha's day, came up in the Mahayana, that after 2,000 years the Dharma would start to decline and then get worse and worse. You maybe hear David's nodding his head. And I think there are times when we can rightly be accused of looking back with rose-colored glasses to the glory days of Zen. That said, I think there are others that would look forward with rose-colored glasses and feel that the more change the better in our tradition. I think that's a kind of dynamic tension that is that's happening now in the West. Okay, so finally I'll say a little bit about what I think Zen might contribute to humanism. I don't think Zen should be allergic to progress. And I think humanism could learn something from Zen about not progress. This doesn't mean like going back to the past or romanticizing it, but honoring stopping and contemplation. You know, Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." Great enlightenment thinker. "I think, therefore I am." In fact, one time he walked into a bar and he ordered a beer. And when he was finished, the bartender said, "Would you have another?" And Descartes said, "I think not," and disappeared. The thing is, Descartes didn't get below the "I think, therefore I am" to "when I'm not thinking, what am I?" And Zen says there's something to learn there. There's something to learn in stopping and losing yourself, a way of progress. And I also think that Zen I think Zen has a tradition and a program of dealing with the interplay between self and no self that can be very useful to human beings and to this culture. I think it values silence and no thinking, and knows that it has a lot to teach us, and non-discrimination as well. I don't think that's in conflict with Enlightenment values. I don't think, the Romantic movement had some of that as well and fought against the Enlightenment. We don't have to fight the Enlightenment. We can, but I think we can contribute to it. Okay. Then I think that we have a bodily practice, as I mentioned. And I think that values like empathy and compassion and open-mindedness can come not only top-down from institutions and ideals, but also from the bottom up. I'd add equality there too. From our body, from practices with our body. And I think that the states and practices of Zen give us strength and equanimity and a certain relationship to non-discrimination and openness that are rooted in our body and therefore can be strong and almost intuitive in a different way. And also this bodies involved in our action, in our ritual. And some of these forms, these ritual forms that we observe, I think are very helpful. And I think sometimes too easily dismissed by the Enlightenment tradition. Alain de Botton has this book called Religion for Atheists, which I've learned a lot from. I really appreciate. And his point is there was a lot of good in those religious structures, even if the God part was suspect. He's an atheist himself. And there are some things that religion does well that atheists forget, like community, like education in the broad sense that includes values and kindness and compassion. And I think that Zen kind of embodies that in a way. We have this religion that doesn't rely on God. We have this way that uses our body, that uses ritual, that stresses community. And I think that can give something to this culture in which we find ourselves. Well, those are some kind of shaggy thoughts. I'm at the beginning I feel like 10 years from now, I'm going to give a better talk on this. But I do, I don't want this to, I'm not going to give a talk like this that often because I'm a Zen teacher primarily, and I want to teach Zen and how to do it. But I think now and then it's important to step back and look at the broader picture. Thanks.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.